I'd just like to tell you all a little story about a somewhat related but actually different project that our department was involved with over the past, actually about a year ago. We embarked with a project with the community, and we wanted to do a health storytelling project with our various cultural communities. And held storytelling groups across the city with male groups, female groups, across African-American groups, Somali, Asian, American Indian. And part of what we heard, especially what was telling to me that I took away from the male groups in particular, was that when we asked men to define what health meant to them, what they said was they wanted to be role models for their families, for their friends, for their communities. And I think that's just a very telling thing to me about working with males, is oftentimes we get mired in the problems that males have or the problems that we say that they cause. But too often, I don't think that we in public health and in this field have seen males as being partners who can help us in our mission. And so I just think that that's something we should all take to heart when we're looking at that male coming through the door of our clinic. Instead of seeing him as a penis with a drip coming out of it, to see him as someone who is a person who wants to be a contributor and really approach him in that way. And so what I'm here to tell you about is a collaborative project that I've been involved with over the last 5 years, with great thanks to OFP and Title 10 for the funding. The name of the project is Seen on the Streets. Some of the challenges that we had in Minneapolis are very similar probably to many of the challenges that you all have where you're from. Chlamydia in Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, had been rising. And is concentrated in urban areas and exhibits very large racial disparities that I think we've heard from many of the presenters in this conference. Another challenge is that the communities that are experiencing the greatest burden of disease also experience the highest barriers to care. And I think another thing, when we were talking this morning about healthcare reform and some of the initiatives that are in place, I think a lot of those guidelines and things. We have guidelines in place for women, but men are not part of that equation yet fully. And I think we really need to look at that. We have ICSI guidelines for chlamydia screening among sexually active females in the age group, but not for males. I think another thing was that the majority of interventions that are most effective in reaching populations are connected with school programs or community centers and that type of thing. And we in Minneapolis felt that there was a group of young men that we needed to be we're responsible for, who are not connected to those institutions, who may have dropped out of school, aren't necessarily in some of the youth development programs that we'd like them to be in. And we're concerned that we were not reaching them with services and with education. I think all of you know, some of the disparities in the STD rates. Reported rates of chlamydia are 14 times higher among African Americans compared to whites, 15 to 19. Prevalence data bears out some of that same disparity as well. The reported rates obviously are just people who come in for testing, but prevalence data from NHANES indicate that the racial disparity persists. That disparity is also what we see in Minneapolis. African Americans have the highest rates of disease in Minneapolis. And this really hit home to us when a report came out in 2003, which showed it was a comparison of various health outcomes across the 50 largest cities in the United States. And Minneapolis ranked number one in both the chlamydia rate and gonorrhea rate among African Americans. And that was something we knew we had an issue with that population, but really that hit home to us that, this is something that we really need to be focusing some attention on. I think there's a lot of factors that play into these racial disparities. It's not because of race, but because of all the things that are associated with race that they come about. There's a lot of misconceptions in the community about the effects of STDs. I've heard from our health educators who have said, they've delivered a positive chlamydia test result to a young man, and he gets, practically starts crying and says, "Am I going to die?" Because they don't necessarily know the difference between HIV, chlamydia, don't know what's treatable, what's not. Obviously, anxiety about testing, urine-based screening has been a great boon to us in that area, but that the word about that has not spread widely in the community, or hadn't at the time of the project that it began. Concerns about privacy and confidentiality are paramount, I think, in the populations that we're dealing with, especially among adolescents, who are a priority population for us. And healthcare clinics are designed to be responsive to their primary users, which typically aren't male, even in non-Title X clinics. Urine specimen collection is also associated with criminal justice investigations, and so getting a young man to pee into a cup may have other connotations to him. And so that's just something that we need to be aware of in dealing with young men. Also, obviously, the issue of asymptomatic STD infection. Some of the system factors that we're up against are segregated sexual networks that have higher rates of infection. If you're living in a community in a sexual, and you're participating in a sexual network where the rate of disease is already very high, that's going to thwart your behavioral attempts to mitigate that. You can have the same behavior as someone in a less risky sexual network and have a worse outcome just because of where you're at. Lack of culturally relevant services. I think a huge issue is that adolescent health is not big business. It's not a moneymaker for health institutions, and so it often goes by the wayside and ignored. Incarceration is a huge issue in our African American population in Minneapolis. So we have a high rate of disparity in terms of incarceration and involvement with the criminal justice system, and the effects on relationships and families, I think, are very devastating, and something that really breaks apart families, and something that we need to look more into. And then also lack of access to health education and service. Obviously, I talked about there being a group of men who aren't necessarily connected to schools and youth programs, but also within those institutions, comprehensive sexuality education has not been implemented in a systematic way. And so this purpose of this talk here today is to describe our project here on the streets, which is designed to improve the sexual and reproductive health of males, to investigate the results of outreach and health education components of the project, and to examine the trends in gonorrhea and chlamydia screening at project clinics before and during the project. And so the partners in this project, I'm from the City of Minneapolis Health Department. We provided the project coordination and the evaluation to the project. We worked with two community-based clinics, Fremont Clinic, which is in North Minneapolis, and Teenage Medical Service on the south side. Fremont Clinic is a community clinic. It serves the community at large. Teenage Medical Service is the adolescent outpatient unit of our local children's hospital. And then we also work with the Minnesota Department of Health, which was a key partner, especially their infertility prevention project, in helping us providing us with some of the data for the evaluation. So I think that's a key point as well, is that the existence of that program really helped us in terms of evaluating our effectiveness. And so this project is a peer outreach model that recruits youth from the community, from alternative schools, community agencies, and project outreach. They are employed by the clinics themselves and supervised by a male health educator who resides at the clinic. The characteristics of our youth, we really wanted to make sure that the youth that we employed represented the populations that we were asking them to go and provide outreach to. And so their age was 17 to 25, and 75% of them were male. We did hear both from clients and from the outreach workers themselves that they thought it wasn't necessary to be a male to be an outreach worker working in male health. And in fact, some of the female outreach workers told us that they could approach males in a slightly different way and provide them with a level of realism and the female perspective on some of these issues that was more effective than just guy talk. The ability to interact with and represent the target population was obviously hugely important. And also, the health educators were really the ones who were instrumental in trying to pick youth who were seen as leaders in their peer groups, people who were already seen as resources in a lot of ways, but didn't necessarily have any training in these areas in sexual health, reproductive health. Our target population was African American males, age 15 to 24. Our staff are identified by project T-shirts and bags. They worked in pairs for safety, and at times they suspended street outreach activities due to violent situations in the community, and that was sort of a concern of the project throughout. was making sure that wherever they were safe. And they really, they met with the target population where they were at. And so they were on the corner, they were in local parks, they were in youth centers, they were in alternative schools and places like that, local businesses. And basically they would just approach groups of young men with clinic information, hand them a card and say, you know, I work for Fremont Clinic and I'd just like to tell you a little bit about our programs and services. And then they'd engage them in a conversation about health education messages, about do they use condoms, do they know how to use a condom. They provide risk assessments and referrals. They'd also provide condoms, and in some cases, we also implemented outreach STI screening, urine samples. And so that was a key innovation that we found was helpful in breaking down some of the barriers to testing that we saw. And we started that only after our outreach workers were out in the community and would see young men who told them that they were at high risk. In fact, they might say, gosh, I think I have something going on. I don't know. And they'd say, well, gosh, it really sounds like you need to go to the clinic. And the guy would just never show up. And so there were barriers, even once someone who had information wasn't not enough to get them there. And even, you know, perhaps symptoms weren't even always enough. We know that guys can put off and put off and put off until it's falling off. So, unfortunately. I think another key aspect of the program was the marketing and media approach that the health educators and the peer educators used. And they were really adept at knowing what was popular, what was effective in reaching youth. And it's not me going into a classroom and droning on and on about STDs and how to use a condom, but it's really important to deliver useful information in the language that the target population spoke, and really approaching them as almost an advertisement. This is a population that's always on the move. They have lots of other competing priorities, and they're not going to sit there and listen to you lecture them. And so really trying to distill the information and provide it in a way that was meaningful. And I'll provide a couple examples of that. Then also empowering youth to make a difference. I think a huge aspect of the project was our ability to be able to employ these peer outreach workers as resources for their community to make a difference in their community. But we would even have, they developed their own little cliques of people who would kind of roll around with them. If they knew they were coming to a park, they'd have some of their friends who would meet them there and kind of help them out and things. So, it was these messages and this knowledge was power, and being a resource to the community was power to these youth. And we used a variety of different promotional materials to appeal to youth. We had one of our male health educators was very talented in music. Produced some public service announcements, took the peer outreach workers down to a local studio where we got a very low rate on time for recording, recorded PSAs and put them on the air, and not your typical health promotion PSA. I mean, these were really great raps and things that really had a beat to them, but also gave the information that was necessary. They sponsored and were present at community youth events. They developed wrist bags, string backpacks, and T-shirts. They have MySpace and Facebook. They also communicated a lot by cell phone and text message, which is really the way that young people communicate today. And so this is an example. This is the cover of a CD that they produced. So part of what's on the CD is the public service announcements, but they also work with local artists to provide other songs. And the songs aren't necessarily about sexual health, but they did want to create a positive environment for the PSAs to be in. And so I think there was a lot of work that went into that. And then the other side is a newspaper advertisement that we put out in a local newspaper called The Trendsetter, which is sort of a weekly that tells about upcoming shows and things that's very popular among youth. Also sponsored a big homies jam, a community celebration at a local park, and provided outreach testing at that venue. Now sort of the boring part of some of our data collection, but we did have a fairly rigorous, though not completely rigorous, research protocol, we had our outreach workers collecting data on every single outreach contact that they saw. They collected the demographic information about the individual they were talking to, as well as recording the health education topics and sexual health risk assessments. The STD screenings were, that data collection, like I said, was provided by the Infertility Prevention Project. We had almost 10,000 contacts between April 2004 and September 2007, and 3,321 gonorrhea and chlamydia tests. I'm going to run through the next couple slides pretty quick here. I do also have this information in a journal article that I could pass out if people are interested in actually getting down and dirty with the data. But some of the things that we did see were over the course of the 4 years of the project that we're looking at here, the percentage that used condoms every time, we saw an initial increase, and then in year four we actually saw a big decrease, and we found that that was due to one particular outreach worker who was a female, and she said that, you know, guys couldn't lie to her, and so she felt like she was better at getting that information. But we did also see over the course of the project, and I think that just highlights, I think, in this field the problem with self-reported sexual behavior measures. But I think a more telling detail and something that isn't perhaps quite as prone to bias, or at least not bias over time, is ever tested for an STD went up substantially over the 4 years of the project. And I think that's also borne out in the results from actual tests at our project clinics in our target population age group and among males. And so we saw almost a doubling of tests in that time. Just also happy to report that the report that ranked big cities came out again in 2008 with 2005 data showing that our ranking among African Americans fell for both chlamydia and gonorrhea. And this was not true. This was at a time when chlamydia had been increasing in almost every other location in the United States, which was surprising to us. So we were successful in reaching a large number of men. Really what was important here, and I think Mandy talked about this a lot, was the clinic buy-in. It wasn't just that we tacked on an outreach program to existing clinical services, but we did secret shoppers of the waiting rooms. We talked with the front desk staff about how they could better serve young men. We did trainings with providers. Really it was an investment by the clinic from the front desk staff all the way to the administrative level. This project is seen as really something that the clinics can hold up as a success story when they're talking about the good work they're doing in the community. We gained the trust of the target population, and we also gained the trust of a lot of partner organizations. Now we're seen as, whereas at the beginning of the project, we were knocking on people's doors trying to get in, now we have our phones ringing off the hook with people wanting us to come back and provide them with more services. So some of the future research challenges: how can we increase the validity of self-reported sexual behaviors? And sort of, this is sort of a research problem. What methods can be used to increase follow-up data collection among disenfranchised populations? And I think a big question for the field of this field in terms of male involvement is, does intensive male screening reduce reinfection rates among female partners? Which is really, I think, an important question that we weren't able to answer here with our project, but hopefully future projects will be able to. Some acknowledgments. Fred Evans, one of my partners, could not be here with me today, but I would like to have him here with us. He's our male health educator at Fremont Clinic. Our health educator at TANS Clinic was Tremaine Williams, colleagues at the Department of Health. And if people need more information, feel free to get in touch with me. Thanks.